Chapter 20.
And keep the spirits flowing,
Weaver Ortson told the waiter, pouring his drink.
I don't want to see the bottom of this cup all night.
I doubt you'll be able to see anything if you keep drinking at this rate, commented Bowlby Bags. Or at least you won't remember it.
Fenrir Goldson looked more dour than usual.
Who'd want to remember today?
Ortson drank his wine in a few long gulps and held out his glass again. The waiter, to his discredit, had already wafted away, taking the drinks cart with him.
It's a historic occasion, said Bags.
It's a macabre fiasco. The ashes are still warm in the pyre,
Ortson murmured into his wine.
It hasn't yet been 3 weeks since Handor's death.
We're all aware of the date, Ortson, muttered Goldson, glancing around uncomfortably. Not least because this month has been cursed.
And it isn't over. That's the point,
Ortson said. The death of Handor had been the start of a series of calamities, and even the least suspicious of Andoran's citizens hoped that the end of Dawngreen would bring some relief from misfortune.
The timing warrants comment.
On the contrary, it warrants keeping quiet, snapped Bags.
The great hall of Andoran's palace inspired some of the halflings' unease. White funeral lilies were set at the doorways. Black banners of mourning still hung from the rafters and draped over the furniture. Handor's ceremonial crown sat wreathed in white and crimson roses atop a black silk pillow on the vacant throne. Yet amidst the dreary decor, tables had been set up and decorated with white silks and overflowing bouquets. Half of the room had been cleared out for a dance floor. Nobles, dignitaries, and captains of industry sat around the tables, contorting their faces as they tried to look happy for the new couple while maintaining an appropriate somberness.
I think we should just agree that it warrants another drink,
Ortson raised his empty glass at a passing servant.
Always a safe proposition with you, said Goldson. An especially good one today, added Bags.
Hold on.
Ortson squinted and peered into the crowd.
Is that Danil Clubs?
Where?
Asked Bags.
Over there, the one in the ridiculous pompadour wig,
Ortson pointed.
I don't believe that's the case, said Bags.
Oh, it's unmistakably Clubs, said Ortson. Listen, you can hear the lout boasting across the hall.
Quite so, but I don't believe that's a wig, said Bags. Clubs is a gnome of my clan, you see, and that hairstyle is quite popular among some of my kin. A halfling, said Goldson, but he's almost as tall as an elf. A glandular disorder, I'm told, said Bags. Well, that explains the tiny hands.
Goldson held out his glass, and a servant filled it with a Dalen wine.
Who cares about how he bloody looks?
Ortson bristled as he stared at the businessman, laughing across the room.
That buffoon is the one who vouched for the Lich's Shell Company. He's the reason those thrice-cursed orbs were on the wall. Do you know how many good men and women we lost in that fight?
It was most likely unintentional, said Goldson. He lacks the competence for subterfuge.
Bags smirked into his own glass.
Burn what he meant, barked Ortson. He's personally responsible for this travesty.
Preposterous. Bags snorted. It's business. You can't go about holding business leaders accountable for everything that goes wrong, added Goldson. Indeed, said Bags. People of a certain level are running small empires. We can't be expected to monitor every little detail.
Little?
Ortson's jowls quivered as he shook with rage.
Thousands of bannermen and heroes died. Uncountable civilians are at risk. The whole world may be in danger because of his dealings.
Goldson and Bags looked unaffected.
Well, I'm fairly certain someone was fired over it, said Goldson.
That's hardly enough for me. His negligence was criminal,
harumphed Ortson.
Nobody is above the law.
Bags shrugged and sipped his wine.
Perhaps, but with enough money, you can usually get out from under it. We have other concerns for the moment, said Goldson. The groom is coming.
Weaver looked. Through his agitated, inebrious haze, he could see Johann the Mighty making his way toward their table. The paladin's ivory teeth sparkled like the candelabras above, and he must have purchased a glamour for the evening, for his golden hair seemed to wave in a breeze that wasn't there. He was, as always, clad in enchanted armor, though today he wore a white cape, and perched atop the gorget of his chest plate a small bow tie.
"Ha-ha! Weaver! Bags! Fenrir! So glad you could make it!"
Johann trumpeted. He gave Ortson a slap on the back for good measure. "Are you having fun? Quite the ceremony, eh? But nobody's dancing yet."
"Perhaps it is the timing of the event, sire," said Goldson. "The difficulties throughout the city are dampening many spirits, ours included."
Ortson took a deep breath and nodded.
"And it's not been a month since the tragedy at Highwatch," he said, trying not to stare at clubs.
"The kingdom is still in mourning,"
Bags added.
"Ah, yes. We all miss good King Handor, Tandos Hold'em. Some people say Marja and I courted too fast."
Johann grabbed a fluted champagne glass and took a swig. "But I don't believe in such an idea. The heart wants what it wants."
"Does it?"
asked Ortson, shooting a sidelong glance at Queen Marja.
"Indeed, we've all noted what high spirits Her Majesty has been in of late,"
said Bags.
"Yes, it must be a powerful love to pull her from her grief, or the unrest on the wall, or the coming undead threat,"
said Goldson.
"Or her tea cakes," added Ortson.
"Exactly! Ha! With a bond as strong as ours, we couldn't possibly wait," said Johann. "Besides, my lady knows I saved her from Dutar Ermion before. I shall do it again."
"Naturally, sire," said Bags. "Good show."
"But on that note, I must discuss affairs of our security with my most trusted advisors, away from prying eyes."
Johann winked and pointed at a gaggle of waving nobles. "Care to join me on the terrace?" Guests hurried out of their way as Johann and his retinue crossed the ballroom. The paladin blew a kiss to Marja, and she stopped eating tea cakes for just long enough to return it. Then a pair of servants opened the great doorway to the balcony, and Ortson found himself standing with Goldson, Bags, and Johann in the cold night. The stars glittering above them seemed almost a faint reflection of the lights of Andoran shining below. Goldson took an imperial cigar from a case in his front pocket. Bags retrieved a long pipe and began stuffing it with dried leaves from a pouch. Ortson stuck with his trusted vice and poured himself a finger of dwarven whiskey from a small cart that had been wheeled out onto the balcony.
"Ah, smell that fresh air!"
Johann took a deep breath, sauntering up to the balcony railing. "It's the sort of night that makes you glad to be alive. Ha! And if we want to stay that way, we need a plan to take down Dutar Ermion."
"Of course," said Bags, "though naturally we believe responsibility for defense lies with the kingdom, and not the business community,"
added Goldson.
"True enough," said Johann, "but the chaos on the wall hasn't been good for the kingdom's coffers. The royal treasurer keeps mentioning combined lateral threats in the market, or something like that."
"Collateralized threat obligations."
Goldson's scowl was even more pronounced as he spat the words, as though the term itself was bitter.
"Sounds right," Johann shrugged and poured himself a drink. "The point is that Andoran will need gold to train more bannermen and recruit heroes."
"Much more gold for the heroes. They'll be demanding big premiums to face a threat that took the lives of so many."
Ortson felt a lump rising in his throat and tried to wash it back down with a splash of whiskey.
"Just give them an expanded share of the loot," said Bags.
"Well, that's a given," agreed Ortson. "But you can't kill a monster with a weapon you haven't looted yet. Guild heroes will want to equip themselves with top-quality gear and consumables, and that will require upfront payments." "I'm certain that when the undead come calling, merchants and heroes alike will answer the call of duty," said Johann. "Their kingdom needs them."
"Then their kingdom will very likely need vast sums of gold," said Ortson.
"I'm sure you'll find some way to make it work, Ortson. Ha! And let us worry about the finances. Right, gentlemen?"
"Quite,"
said Bags, with the uneasy caution of an explorer who has spotted a suspicious log drifting toward him in a tropical swamp.
though I'm unsure of what precisely we could do, added Goldson.
Johann took a sip of his drink and stared out over the balcony.
Your firm could purchase Thakovia Bank for a start.
I beg your pardon? Said Goldson.
Thakovia, said Johann. Scoria's biggest bank. Or it was before this horrible business on the wall. Now their stock is plummeting.
That sounds precisely like the sort of firm that Goldson Bags would not like to buy, said Bags.
Why would we?
Asked Goldson. To stabilize the market? To shore up the tax base? Or perhaps to satisfy a royal edict? Laughed Johann. Though I hoped there was no need for such a formality among friends. Goldson and Bags glanced at each other with narrowed eyes.
My apologies for any insult, sire, said Bags. We didn't realize you had already been coronated. Given that the wedding was but an hour ago, said Goldson.
Think nothing of it, said Johann, with something between magnanimity and indifference. I certainly won't. Ha-ha! Anyway, cake is in 5 minutes, and then we'll do the first dance, and then the coronation.
How expedient, said Bags carefully.
What can I say? Johann grinned as he opened the door to the ballroom. The heart wants what it wants. Ha! I'll leave you three to work out the details. I'm sure I'll see you by the buffet. Try the griffin. It's phenomenal. The paladin pointed at the businessman, made a clicking noise with his tongue, and strutted back into the reception.
Well, this is an interesting development, said Bags as the door to the balcony shut. Only if you have a fascination with tragedy, snorted Goldson.
Do you think purchasing Thakovia will stabilize the market?
Ortson asked.
Stabilize the market? Bags said incredulously. Good gods, man! Have you been listening to the town criers? Or watching the figures from the wall? Or listening to your own guild's proclamations?
I've been focused on other things, Ortson said.
It was technically true, although all of those things had been poured from bottles and taken neat.
I'm sure you have, said Bags. But what about the quests you signed this morning?
Ortson thought back over the day. Mostly he remembered trying to get into formal wear without spilling his cocktail, but somewhere in there were hazy visions of putting his seal on several sheaves of paperwork.
I vaguely recall them, he said truthfully.
Mr. Goldson rolled his eyes.
Well, Mr. Ortson, let it suffice to say that I don't believe our impending purchase of Thakovia will help matters. Things are too far gone for such a simple solution.
Is it truly that bad? Asked the guildmaster.
Bags leaned against the railing of the balcony and took a long puff of his pipe.
Mr. Ortson, consider that since the fall of Highwatch, the threat index for the Freedlands and Ruskin has skyrocketed. Almost every threat obligation written in the last decade has been triggered.
I'm well aware. The rising indexes have done no small damage to the guild coffers, said Ortson.
True enough, but at least you know what you owe, said Goldson, taking a drink. Now, consider that almost every financial institution out there has discovered, and continues to discover, that through their investments, they are responsible for billions of gilton in threat obligations due to their direct and indirect investments in CTOs. Perhaps trillions, said Bags. Those CTO funds are worse than worthless now. Nobody will pay into them until they pay out. They're all debt. The Royal Bank of Scoria announced last week that half of their assets were actually liabilities.
Goldson shuddered.
Now, look at the lights of the city,
Bags said, pointing at the tiers below with his pipe.
You can be sure that next to each tiny glow, there's a person who watched their retirement savings, their pension, their bank account, all of it, evaporate faster than the melting snow. And rest assured that they are all beyond anger.
They'll be out for blood, Ortson paled.
They already are, said Goldson, especially given those quests you signed.
Exactly, said Bags.
Finally, consider how many of those lights are moving.
The glow of the torchlight crept through the windows of Dwin Poldo's Boulderfolk office. Unseen crowds marched in the streets outside, their shouts punctuated by the occasional crash of windows shattering.
"It was a mistake coming here," the Scribkin muttered.
The wood gnome on his shoulder chirruped sharply.
"Yes, I know you told me."
Poldo had decided that it was vital to retrieve several documents and shutter the old office before the wall was engulfed in complete chaos. Nobody else knew the combination to the safe, nor which papers were important, so he had made the trip personally. Now, however, the flaws in his plan were becoming apparent. It wasn't that the reasoning was bad, but the timing certainly was. Poldo's miscalculation had brought him to Boulderfolk moments before the arrival of an angry mob.
"How do we get out of here?" he muttered.
Several wood gnomes chittered from a pile of gardening equipment.
"Good idea," said Poldo.
After some rummaging and a bit of a struggle, Poldo emerged from the shed wearing overalls and a wide-brimmed garden hat. One of Boulderfolk's gardeners was a halfling, so the overalls were a bit long in the leg and spacious around the middle, but with the cuffs tucked into rubber boots and the midsection stuffed with paperwork and nervous wood gnomes, Poldo looked like he wore the gardening clothes every day. At least he hoped he did. With a deep breath, he grabbed a pitchfork and pushed through the hedge. The north gate was already twisted off its hinges, and it was easy enough to join the mob milling throughout the courtyard. The Scribkin stabbed the air with his pitchfork and marched with pantomimed outrage into the street. It was like leaping into a river of anger. The dizzying press of bodies around him, the smell of sweat and smoke, and the blurring lights threatened to overwhelm Poldo. A current of shouting, furious people carried him through the streets of the eighth tier until an eddy finally deposited him in a small alleyway near the broad steps. The Scribkin cowered away from the shouting crowds, watching them rage by as he caught his breath. He was in such a state that it took several minutes before he realized that he wasn't alone in the alley. Turning slowly, he found a pile of rags that stared back with a familiar face.
"Fitch?"
"Poldo," gasped Fitch.
"Oh, thank the gods. Poldo, we have to get out of here." "Hush, I know,"
Poldo snapped, ushering the halfling behind a dumpster.
"What are you doing anyway?"
"I was holed up in Mr. Stern's office when the riots broke out,"
Fitch said.
"But pretty soon the mob broke down the door, and we had to make a run for it. I got myself separated from him."
"You lost Mr. Stern?"
"Eventually, yeah. It took no small effort."
A hint of relief flashed over the halfling's grimy face.
"Good gods, man! You just left him at the mercy of the rioters?"
demanded Poldo.
"I'm just trying to keep all my guts where they belong,"
Fitch insisted.
"It's life and death out there, Poldo. You know how many bankers fell off the wall today?"
"I heard several professionals jumped,"
said Poldo. Fitch gave him an odd look.
"Jumped? Maybe. I mean, I would too if there was a pack of heroes chasing me."
"Guild heroes?"
Poldo gasped.
"Is there another kind? Lamia's sisters got declared a foe this morning.
Surely not Pradessa and Malice."
Poldo had met Andoran's most powerful Naga on several occasions.
"They were two of the first NPCs. They're patrons of the arts, pillars of society.
All the guild cares about is that they were a perceived threat sitting on top of a lot of wealth. A quest with their name on it got signed this morning, and now they're handbags."
Fitch shook as he spoke.
"But I was talking about their bank, Poldo. The guilds didn't just declare the sisters foes. They made the Lamia sisters' corporate office a dungeon, and everyone working there a henchman."
Poldo shook his head slowly.
"I just can't believe it. The public's lost a lot of their money, Poldo, and watching a rich man bleed feels like justice to an angry pauper,"
said Fitch.
"If Goldson and Bags were a goblin and a gnoll, they'd be dead already. Heck, if the markets get much worse, I'm not sure even their skin will save them. But for now, the guild is mostly targeting Shadowkin and Darkforged."
"The Shadowkin!"
Poldo's mind leapt to the tenants that Mrs. Herc had brought into his home, and his stomach leapt into his throat. He took a deep breath.
"We have to get out of here. That's what I've been saying," said Fitch.
They deposited Fitch's coat, suspenders, and footwear in the dumpster, and found a colorful rag that could serve as a foul bandana. With his shirt untucked and Poldo's pitchfork in hand, the halfling looked like another angry gardener, albeit one with suspiciously well-tailored pants. Disguise in place, the pair leapt back into the tide of people rushing down the street. The mob proceeded to the broad steps in disorderly fashion, breaking windows and shouting at nearby bannermen. The stairs to the 9th and 10th tiers were blocked by elven bannermen and a contingent of heroes, prompting most of the rioters to turn around and march back down another street of the 8th. Many stopped to watch a commotion up on the wall. A few, however, broke off and made their way down the steps to the lower tiers. Poldo and Fitch joined them, trying to blend in with the thinning crowd without getting too close to any of them. They were halfway down the steps to the 7th tier when Fitch elbowed Poldo in the arm and jabbed a thumb over his shoulder. Poldo turned back and saw the spectacle that had transfixed so many of the other rioters on the steps. The 8th tier was near the top of the wall, and the activity on the tier was visible to anyone on the broad steps. It made for a sort of raised stage, and on it, a group of professional heroes performed a deadly dance. They darted around a shadowy foe and loosed colorful pyrotechnic attacks. From their center came a low growl, and then a roar as a hulking ursine form reared up among them. Poldo gasped.
"Is that shut up?" Fitch hissed.
Mr. Stern, or at least the giant bear that Mr. Stern periodically turned into, loosed a furious roar and swiped at his assailants with massive claws. But the party assaulting him was prepared to deal with his transformation, and the bursts of magic around him were suddenly punctuated by flashes of silver weapons. A shining arrow caught the werebear in the throat, and with a final roar, the lycanthrope toppled backward off the wall.
"Good gods," breathed Poldo.
Fitch grabbed the Scribkin by the arm and hurried him down the steps.
"Just keep moving!"
They hurried down the steps while trying to look unhurried, quickly sidling along with desperate nonchalance. They made their way down to the 5th tier, where they splintered off from the other drifting rioters, then ducked into a side street before breaking into full sprints. Sprinting to any degree, however, is not an activity that gnomish bankers engage in very often. Poldo made a mental note that he needed to exercise more as he staggered up to the gated yard in front of his home. A couple of wood gnomes crawled from his overalls to pat him on the back as he doubled over, hands on his knees. He still hadn't caught his breath when Fitch flopped down on the cobblestones next to him.
"What? Where?
Poldo just shook his head and pointed to the sign that Mrs. Herc had recently erected over the doorway. Thin brass letters read, "Mr. Poldo's Home for the Displaced." Fitch just shook his head and stared up at the sign with a perplexed expression.
I have some matters I must attend to," Poldo breathed. "Is it collecting your money?"
Fitch managed eventually.
"No, I..." "Then forget it," the halfling pleaded. "Come on, Poldo. The guild may not declare us foes, but soon investors are going to come asking questions. Gods, the undead aren't going to stay holed up in High Watch forever. They might even make it here. Andoran isn't safe for us." "I just have to see to it. It doesn't matter whatever it is," Fitch insisted. "Any business you had here is over. Learn to fail well. I suggest buying a bar on some island in the TGM Sea and serving fruity drinks for the rest of your life."
Poldo stiffened.
"Failing well is exactly what I intend to do, Mr. Fitch. It seems we just have different definitions of the term." "Well, mine involves sandy beaches and Tinderkin and grass skirts,"
Fitch pointed baseward.
"I've arranged a secure carriage down by the river, and I'm headed there once I fetch my gold. This is your last chance to join me."
Poldo nodded and extended his hand.
"Good luck, Mr. Fitch."
Fitch stared at the offered hand for a moment, then shook it uncertainly.
"Yeah. Yeah, good luck to you too, Poldo."
And then the halfling was away. A wood gnome scrambled up Poldo's arm and chittered a question. Poldo looked up at his eponymous home for the displaced. He could see Mrs. Herc's silhouette peering down from a window above.
"Yes, I'm staying because it's for our residence," he told the gnome on his shoulder. "Come, we have much to do."
"Now the hard work begins," said Johann, the crown of the Freedlands resting amidst his golden locks. The paladin's eyes swept over the crowd standing beneath the dais. "We've been through hard times, and harder times are coming, but now is a time for all of us to come together."
"Together,"
echoed Queen Marja, still in her white wedding dress. The assembled nobles, business people, and town criers gave the king a light smattering of applause.
Only together can we rally our defenses against the evils of Datar Ermion.
Johann strutted about the stage, flashing his impeccable grin at the attendees.
Only together can we rebuild what we've lost. Only together can we keep our families safe. Which is why I hope this kingdom can do as my lovely bride and I have, and unite despite our losses.
Unity,
said Marja, clapping. And on that note, my lovely bride has prepared a few remarks. Johann turned and gestured to the queen. This announcement raised eyebrows around the throne room. It was widely known that in her previous marriage, Queen Marja had preferred to let King Handor see to the public speaking, along with all matters of diplomacy, policy, and ceremony. A popular joke within the halls of the castle was if you wanted Marja's attention on a matter, the best course of action was to write it in frosting on a tea cake. The queen shuffled a pack of note cards as she stepped in front of the dais.
Ahem. The undead are invading the Friedlands. We face a danger that,
Marja briefly stopped reading to flip to the next card,
that is unlike anything we have faced. I must ask that we put aside our differences and divisions and unite behind our new, king.
Marja looked up from her notes with evident relief. Perhaps her relative success had given the queen a sudden rush of confidence because she added some commentary of her own.
Now I know you must have questions.
It was a rookie mistake. Most public figures with any experience in speeches avoid mentioning questions, or discussion, or anything that would give the town criers an excuse to begin shouting inquiries. Hands sprouted from the crowd like an impromptu forest, accompanied by a chorus of shouted questions.
Why marry so soon? Did you and Johann court before Handor's death?
Why was King Handor on the front lines at High Watch?
What's become of the eagle that carried Handor and Johann? Ha-ha!
King Johann's laughter was booming as he stepped in front of Marja, but his grin seemed more brittle.
Friends, I hear your concerns, but we don't have time to waste on these little details. We need to work together to save our nation. After all, isn't that what King Handor would have wanted?